Good morning. Today's scripture reading is 1 Corinthians 2, 1 through 5. And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling. And my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God.
Good morning. It's good to be here. I know it's exciting for Carissa and I to be here, and I hope that our thanks is obvious in the way we've been acting, but I would like to thank you personally. I think I speak for both of us, Carissa and I, when I say you make us feel extremely welcome, and we appreciate that. Now, has anyone in here ever been the most hated person in the room before? Okay, you might raise your hand. Do you really know for sure? Because there's one moment when I was the most hated person in a room of over 200 people. And I'm not just talking about when I preach, okay? But there was a moment that I was, without a doubt, the most hated person in the room. Now, back in my college days during the summer, I worked as a lifeguard. And, excuse me. There we go. Okay. I'll get here eventually. Okay. I worked as a lifeguard at a public pool / water park. And it was a fun job. It was a good summer job. And, you know, I had had all these training beforehand in college, and finally I got to put it to use. And so there I was. I'd sit on the stand. And every once in a while during this job, a local school district would take over the pool. And they would hold a swim meet. They would hold races of kids of all ages, you know, all the way down probably from kindergarten all the way up through the tail end of high school. And they held these races together, and that was the easy day on the job as a lifeguard, right? Because only two or three people are in the pool at a time. You know, they're racing, and you know if they're in a race, they probably know how to swim, right? So you get to sit back and relax, even if you're not going to show that from the stand. Well, there was one particular swim meet in which, for some reason or another, one of the kids got confused. A little kid, probably no older than 8. And as three high schoolers on the other end of the pool were getting set to dive into the water, ready for that whistle to blow, I happened to notice that there was a little kid closer to me, not very close, but he was closer and he was on our end of the pool. He starts getting ready to get into the water. And before I can do anything about it, the woman who was in charge blew the whistle. And the three high schoolers jumped in the water. And so did the boy. And all of a sudden, this kid is on a collision course, swimming directly toward a high schooler in his lane. And so I blow my whistle and I'm calling out, but no one hears because there's about 200 parents in the stands watching and they're cheering. Some of them are screaming about this boy that's now in the water, but none of them can hear me because of the noise. So I just have to stand there and watch the inevitable take place. Smack. This boy went right head first into this high schooler during his race. And so I'm standing there watching, trying to make sure everything's okay. And the high schooler comes up out of the water. He's angry. He's furious. He's yelling because his race was just ruined. We can understand that, right? The boy, the little boy, comes up out of the water and he's crying. But there's no blood. He's not injured. He's staying afloat very well. He seemed to me more startled than anything else. So I begin to wave them in. Now you need to know something about lifeguards. One of the things we were constantly trained with, in fact, one of our mantras was keep it simple, stupid. I'm sure you've heard that. KISS. K-I-S-S. Keep it simple, stupid. If you don't like, I'm not going to call you stupid. So let's say keep it simple, Simon, or keep it simple, Sally, keep it simple, Stuart, however you want to say it. But that was our mantra. Keep it simple. In other words, when you are on the edge of the pool and you don't have to jump in the water, don't do it. It was, in fact, the last resort for a lifeguard to jump into the water. You're not supposed to go in unless you absolutely have to. Why, you might ask? Because why add an unnecessary complication? Why jump in there and add a variable that could mess everything up when you don't have to go in the water? In fact, that same mantra, keep it simple, was a mantra that, you know, rang true in all of being a lifeguard. Every rescue they taught us, every move, every type of swim is designed to use as few muscles as possible and to use as little energy as possible so you can just simply get them out of the water. Well, I have to say, the people in the stands and the people all around me, probably upwards of 300 people if you count it all together, none of them had apparently ever had this training. Because I'm standing there waving the kid in, and before I can do anything about it, a kid who was a high schooler, the son of the woman in charge, takes off his shirt and runs slow motion to the water. And he dives in the water and he swims to this boy. He scoops the boy up and he swims all the way back and he takes him out and he's checking him up and he's saying, "Oh, are you okay?" And all of a sudden, everyone in the stands, all these parents who you can imagine are easily aggravated, are wondering, why do we have a lifeguard here if he's not going to do his job? And I kid you not, the crowd turned on me. They started screaming at me, berating me. And this is hundreds of people yelling from the stands. I even had people coming up to my stand while I'm trying to still do my job, and they're berating me, asking me, "Why are you doing? What are you doing with your life?" You know, they were saying all these horrible things to me until finally the head guard had to take me off the stand and hide me in the break room before the crowd tore me apart. It was crazy. I was literally the most hated guy in the room right then. And I could tell from the angry faces. And it's all because I kept it simple. But you know what? I stand behind my decision there. Okay? Because as a lifeguard, we were taught over and over, don't add an unnecessary complication. No matter how people were to respond to me, that didn't matter. Because I kept it simple. I did what was important. In our lives, I think we have a tendency to overcomplicate matters. That boy, that teenager who wanted to jump in and save this boy, he didn't know he was doubling the child's danger by jumping in there. He didn't know that adding this unnecessary complication was going to make my day a crazy day, but he could have just kept it simple. But we have a tendency in life to overcomplicate matters. We overcomplicate social events. We overcomplicate our jobs a lot of the time. We overcomplicate the church a lot of the time, too. Would you say that we overcomplicate the church's central mission, evangelism? I would suggest that we certainly do. We have all these tracts that we put together. We have, you know, statements that we write down exactly what we're going to say. And we have a big folder. Okay, if they say this, go to page 3. I know what to say in response. Either that, or we go into, you know, down rabbit holes. When somebody asks us, where do you go to church? We go into this deep theological discussion over instrumental music or the preeminence of God. Instead, how about we keep it simple? Keep it simple. Now, this is a mantra that I believe Paul followed. Now, don't get me wrong. There were many times in which Paul got into some weightier matters of the law. There were many times in which Paul got into some complicated territory. But there was a stark contrast between how he would talk to a mature Christian and how he would talk to a new convert or to a potential convert. And here's the message I want to get across to us this morning. Preaching the gospel doesn't have to be complicated. We don't have to make it into this big ordeal. In fact, I think if we follow the model set up in 1 Corinthians chapters 1 and 2, we can actually keep it pretty simple, and it's going to be a lot easier and a lot less arduous for us. So let's go ahead, if you haven't already, go ahead and turn to 1 Corinthians chapters 1 and 2. Obviously, chapter 2, verses 1 through 5 were already read this morning. And in a moment, we're going to get up to that point. But we're going to start there in chapter 1, verse 10. But I think we see something here in these couple of chapters, and that is the simpleness of the cross. The simple message that was given to us isn't complicated, so let's keep it that way. Let's not overcomplicate things that don't need to be overcomplicated. Go ahead and turn there. Let's start in verse 10. Chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians, verse 10. Paul says, "Now I exhort you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment." Paul starts off here with a key verse of the book. If you'd like to underline, I would underline this verse. I believe this is a key passage for the book as a whole. He uses a petition verb there. "I urge," he says. So what is he urging them? Anytime a Bible writer says, "I urge you to do something," we got to pay attention to what he's saying. Well, what does he urge here? He urges that they be unified, that they stop fighting, that they stop bickering, that they be united in the same mind and in the same judgment. If you read the rest of this book, you'll realize that the Corinthian church had a major problem with unity. There were contentious members among their group. There were people causing fights. There were people who didn't care if they offended their fellow brethren. And then there were others who were not, they weren't even eating the Lord's Supper together. They were eating it separately. "I'm not going to wait for this guy to get here." So they would, Paul says they'd get drunk while another person doesn't get any of the wine at all. And so there was a huge unity problem here in the Corinthian church. And Paul wanted throughout the book to tell them, you've got to be united. And I want us to understand, even though this isn't a main point of my lesson, I want you to understand, evangelism all starts here with a united, loving church group. It all starts with the fact that we're a family, and then we can add others into our family. It starts there. If there are problems in the church, if there are members, or if there's a big division among the members, then we're going to have a hard time in our evangelism. So it's got to start there. Now, I'll say, in the short time I've been here, I've realized you're very, and I hope to say we are a very united congregation. And I really appreciate that. So I don't think we have a lot of the same problems that the Corinthian church did. But look at what Paul says when he continues. He goes into specifics as to what one of their main problems or issues was. Verse 11. "For I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there are quarrels among you. Now I mean this, that each one of you is saying, I am of Paul, and I of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ." So basically, they're acting like children on a schoolyard. They're picking team captains. Some are saying, "Well, I was baptized by Paul, therefore I'm a disciple or a follower of Paul." And then others are saying, "No, I'm a follower of Apollos." And others still have added even Christ into this mix. And Paul, I think we can see, is infuriated by this. He can't stand that this is happening. Look what he says, verse 13. "Has Christ been divided? Paul was not crucified for you, was he? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one would say you were baptized in my name." And then I love verse 16. He says, "Well, I did baptize some other people." He kind of adds it in there. But his point is, he's glad he didn't baptize a bunch of people because he would hate to see a faction rise up in the church that is under his own name. And then he says, verse 17, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, so that the cross of Christ would not be made void." Now, if you don't know the context, it seems here that Paul is saying something that's drastically different than we would think, right? He says, "Christ did not send me to baptize." And we say, whoa, hold it, Paul. What are you saying there? Obviously, when we talked about the Great Commission earlier, it's on the screen, it's on this poster behind me. It says baptizing them, right? Jesus said, when you go out into the world, you've got to baptize them. You've got to teach them. So what does Paul mean here when he says he wasn't sent to baptize? Well, I think what he's getting at is clear when you look at the context. He's saying he didn't come to the Corinthians to set himself up on a pedestal. He didn't go to the Corinthians with these wise words, and we're going to see him say that later on. He didn't go to them trying so that they could look up to him as this great idol to worship. Instead, a leader of the church, their job is to just preach. He knew that as long as he just preached the gospel, he had done his job. Didn't matter how people responded. That's up to them. What was up to him is that he preached the gospel. He knew he was not some great figure to be looked up to. In fact, I think this is the first point we can draw from this text. If you want to keep it simple, you need to remember it's not about you. Paul knew this. It wasn't about how many people he had converted. It wasn't about how cool he looked or how smart or wise he looked to the group. It wasn't about how well he came off. It was about preaching Christ and him crucified. It was about preaching the gospel. And he knew it wasn't about him. And we need to remember this. We need to take this idea to heart in our own lives, because when we take our own ego out of the equation, it becomes a lot more simple, doesn't it? A lot of times when we go out and when we try to spread the gospel, we're so concerned with how we're going to look or with how people will respond to us. In fact, let's go ahead and look at the next few verses. I think we see here the second point, and that is that you can't control how people respond. Now, on the offset, that seems scary or that seems sad. We can't control. No matter how hard we try, it's not up to us how they respond. But on the other side of the coin, that should be comforting to us, shouldn't it? We should be comforted by the fact that it's not up to us. We, as long as we preach the gospel, we've done our job, as Paul says there. It's up to them how they respond. Look at what he says, verse 18. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Paul says here, there are a lot of ways you could respond to that cross. And in reality, it's the same now, isn't it? There are some people who the cross is foolish to. There are some people out there in the world today, just like the Greeks were. You know, the Greeks thought that they were philosophers. They thought they were wise among the nations. And therefore, the very idea, the very notion that God came to earth or God came flesh and died on the cross, that very notion was foolish to them. Aren't there many people today who think they're too smart or think they're too highly educated to simply even believe in a God? Much less that the Bible is His Word, much less that Christ is His Son. There are many people who think they're too educated or too smart to believe. They think the cross is foolish. And then on the other hand, just like the Jews who the cross became a stumbling block for because of their own preconceived faith, their preconceived ideology that they didn't want to turn from, the same can be said for many people today, can't it? To many in the world, the cross is foolish or the cross is a stumbling block. But the good news is there are going to be those who will respond to that message. Because the wisdom of God sometimes is foolishness to the people of the world, but some of us are going to recognize the wisdom that there is. We have to remember, it's up to them. You know, this was a hard lesson for me to learn as a preacher. You know, I'd preach and I'd preach and I'd teach and I'd talk to people, and I couldn't make them do what I wanted them to do. And that's still going to be something I struggle with, I'm sure. But it's something we need to all remember in the sense that everyone was given free will. It's up to them how they respond. But for us, our job is done when we tell them about Jesus. And you know what? That makes it much more simple for us, doesn't it? Look at what Paul continues to say in the next few verses here. Verse 25, because the foolishness of God is wiser than man, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world, and the despised God has chosen the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. Verse 30, but by his doing, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption, so that just as it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. Again, that theme of humility comes into the forefront here. Not only was Paul saying that he was not some figure to be put up on a pedestal, but he says that God specifically chose the humble to spread his message because we as humans have no right to boast in ourselves. We must boast in God if we're going to boast. But look at what he says here. Yes, the cross is going to be foolish to those in the world, but it is a powerful wisdom that only some will recognize. And then he basically calls them stupid here. I know I was worried about calling you stupid earlier, with the keep it simple, right? But what does he say here, verse 26? It says, not many of you were wise, according to the flesh. It says, you weren't the sharpest tools in the shed, right? Or, in other words, they weren't highly educated. They weren't these philosophers like the Greeks really like to put up on these pedestals. They were the low class, right? And so often when Jesus taught, he would take the lower class citizens and he would flip everything on its head. The high class became the low and the low became the high class in the kingdom of God. And that's the idea that's being said here, isn't it? It's the low class who are spreading this message. So don't let anyone look down on you. If you're a Christian, don't let anyone look down on you because you're not smart enough or because you're not educated enough. You have the greatest wisdom on this earth you have access to. Don't let anyone look down on your education or on your ability to think. But what's so beautiful about this passage is, again, our third point, you don't have to be quote-unquote wise according to the flesh. You don't have to be mighty. You don't have to be noble. You don't have to be powerful or rich to preach the gospel. So often we think we have to know every page of this book. We have to know every verse before we can go out and actually talk to people about Christ. That's not true. We don't have to be the wisest person of the bunch. We don't have to be, highly educated to spread God's message. And when we realize that, again, it becomes so much more simple, doesn't it? All we have to do is tell them about Jesus, let them respond, and then the fruit and the growth is supplied by God. And really, that's what Paul says here in chapter 2, the verses that were already read. He says, I didn't go to the Corinthians with, wise words. He didn't go to them trying to sound smart. He didn't go to them acting like a philosopher. He went to them hoping only to know the simple cross. Look at verse 2. He says, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He went simply. Why was that? Verse 5, he says, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. And I think that's the crux to this whole message. That's what all these three points are about, isn't it? It's not about us. It's not up to us how people respond, and it's not up to us to be wise philosophers. In other words, he says, stop trusting on the wisdom of men. Stop trusting in yourself and take your trust and place it on God. And really, that's what the motto should become. That motto of keep it simple really needs to become keep it simple, trust in God. Because that's what this is all about. When we take our trust and we give it to God, and we say, God, you're the one who's in control. We don't save. God saves. We engage the world. We preach to the world. But it's not up to us to save people. That's all in God's court. And when we realize that, when we give it all to Him, it becomes much more simple. And it's much easier for us to do. So let's keep it simple. Let's trust in God. Now, one thing you'll have to learn about me, I like to make sure that you take this home with you. So go ahead and repeat this phrase after me. Okay, I'm going to say it, and then you're going to say it. Okay, keep it simple. Trust in God. All right, let's put it together. Keep it simple. Trust in God. Thank you. I hope you'll take that with you. Because this, as long, I believe if we remember to keep it simple and trust in God, God is going to do the work for us. He's the one in control. And believe me, spreading the gospel doesn't have to be complicated. Now, just to prove to you how simple this is, I'm going to give you a bit of simple homework. Okay? And you'll realize this is simple. Okay? Simple homework. If every one of us, every single one of us, were to go out this week and to invite one person to services, just one, I think we could make a big difference in our community. So that's your homework. Every single one of us, let's just invite one person. That's pretty simple, right? That's an easy place to start. And I want you to realize, I'm new to town. I don't know a lot of people. The evangelism is not going to come mainly from me, okay? It's going to come from you guys. You guys know the people around you. You are already entrenched in the community. Let's get to work by doing these simple tasks. Let's just invite one person this week to our assembly together. And let's start there, start small, and I think we can do a lot of good. If you're here this morning and you haven't obeyed the gospel, I want to give you the opportunity to respond. We're going to have an invitation song in just a moment. And the purpose for that is so that if you have any needs or if you haven't obeyed the gospel, you can come forward. We can talk with you about it. We can study or we can pray with you. Whatever your need is, don't hesitate to come. Please come as we stand and as we sing.